This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRE's news director. We've got a lot of stories to get to in the next half hour, including some climate activism and a new network for artisans right here in the Valley, and a presidential campaign stop in Charlottesville. Those reports from the WMRA newsroom this week. We also have reports from Virginia Public Radio on a new film about the state's heroin problem and on Virginia's attorney general race for 2017. It's on already. And wait for it. My interview with Paula Poundstone is coming up too. So let's get started. This week marked the beginning of the UN Global Climate Summit in Paris, and global climate marches took place throughout the world, including in Harrisonburg. In his very first report for WMRA, here's Christopher Clymer Kurtz.
As the dreary Sunday afternoon turned darker and colder, a crowd of more than 150 gathered outside of the Pale Fire Brewing Company in downtown Harrisonburg to sign a giant postcard to Paris and a petition to the Harrisonburg City Council. Ann Nielsen was among the crowd.
We're sending a postcard to Paris hoping that all of the delegates will take this seriously and finally begin to move strongly towards renewable energy and reducing emissions throughout the globe.
Before a 32-feet tall PVC replica of the Eiffel Tower, activists from various groups watched as city resident Earl Martin approached the tower but appeared to stagger under the weight of his lit oil lantern, until his 8-year-old granddaughter Sophie Martin came to his aid with a solar light. Together they left behind the oil lantern, and the solar light was raised up the tower. Sophie has a clear hope.
That people will change to solar power thing instead of fossil fuel.
The postcard to Paris, organizers said, would be photographed and sent to our negotiators and to people in Paris and around the world. The Harrisonburg petition calls for the adoption of environmental performance standards for public and private development and will be delivered in January. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer Kurtz.
Harrisonburg and Rockingham County artisans literally are being put on the map with a new guided network for tourists and curious locals. It's called the Artisan Trail. Christopher Clymer Kurtz has that story, too.
It's a sunny autumn afternoon in northern Rockingham County, and Jan Direct and Jim Buckingham from Maryland are in the Old Hill Cider Tasting Room at Showalter's Orchard outside of Timberville.
That is completely different. A little more apple-y immediately.
Almost smoky.
They were directed to Showalter's by the Harrisonburg Visitor Center. Next spring, the center will have an additional resource for locating the area's cultural treasures, including this family farm. A new artisan trail network map for the newly named Harrisonburg-Rockingham Artisan Trail. Showalter's Orchard co-owner Sarah Showalter explains the presence of hard cider artisanry on the trail, which bears the tagline, "The Cultural Crossroads of the Shenandoah Valley."
Usually when people think about art, they think about the artist expressing themselves, usually from really traditional things like paint or sculpture or music. But cider, it's nice for us to be able to let people know what our hard ciders are like, because they are pieces of art or they are artisanal. Some of the mass-produced ciders that you find in the grocery store are not so much art. They're more like a chemical composition and taste the same all the time. And when something is the same all the time, that doesn't feel very much like art.
Although registration in the program will be ongoing, artisans wanting to be included in the trail's printed launch brochure map must enroll by mid-March.
You have as much diversity and culture and, I mean, languages spoken here, university here. You really are a cultural crossroad, and you're smack in the Shenandoah Valley. So it's just a perfect fit to have all that wrapped together.
Sherry Smith is the executive director for the Artisan Center of Virginia. She spends her days traveling and working in communities all across the state to establish artisan trail networks now in various stages of development and operation. These trail networks put regional artisans of all sorts, dining, hospitality, arts, agricultural, on a map and on a website so that anyone who wants to can experience the culture and creativity of that region. The Harrisonburg-Rockingham Artisan Trail website is already up and running. The actual maps should be ready by next summer. And on that map, just north of Harrisonburg on Route 42, sits another trail site, Bridgeworks Glass Studio and Warehouse. Co-owner Rebecca Bridge and Bridgeworks manager Key Schimmel stand near their kiln as it cycles back down past 950 degrees.
Pebbly, cobblestone,
But that's just what tempered glass does.
Right.
Most glasses, like, oops, sorry. This.
Yes, this has a real organic edge, whereas this has a nice rounded.
It wants to be a quarter inch.
It does.
Okay, that's as technical as we can get.
An old window frame with a stained glass hot air balloon scene awaits further work on one table. In another part of the shop are racks of colorful sheets of glass. Bridge and Schimmel both say that for them, the artisan trail is an exciting opportunity.
We are not downtown, so we're not readily visible.
We're a destination.
We are a destination, but we have other destinations close to us who say, hey, while you're here, you might want to check out down there.
Farther south in Dayton, Mama's Caboose owner Diane Roll fries the day's last available crab cake. Her food truck, which she has operated since 2011, is parked outside.
Thank you, dear. Can't wait to try it.
Today, she is in her tiny deli, where regulars Carl and Sandy Martin eat with their daughter Maggie every week.
And the food is fantastic. Just out of sight.
Mama's Caboose is one of nearly 40 destinations already enrolled with the Harrisonburg-Rockingham Artisan Trail. Artisan Center's Sherry Smith says that Virginia's artisan trail networks build community and that the center is debt-free thanks to a diverse budget that relies on public funds, but also sponsorships, community and private donations, and membership fees. The trail, Smith says, tells the true fabric of the community and just may assist with finding that perfect piece of pie baked with apples from Showalter's Orchard. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Also this week, former Arkansas governor and Republican presidential candidate Mike Huckabee made a campaign appearance in Culpeper this week. And former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley paid a visit to the University of Virginia on Tuesday evening to try and drum up support for his Democratic presidential bid. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has this report on O'Malley's visit.
What do you do when you're polling in third place in a race to be the Democratic nominee for president? Well, for starters, you beat people to their punchline.
I know that when a man stands before you with 7% national support, he tells you he's running for president of the United States and it's going very well, that there's a fine line between delusion and imagination.
Martin O'Malley packed a full house Tuesday evening at the University of Virginia's Batten School as more than 200 students braved a cold rain to hear the former governor talk about gun control, ISIS, and a subject dear to his audience's heart, reducing college debt. O'Malley is currently trailing far behind his Democratic rivals, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders. In his most favorable recent poll, he has 7% of the vote, compared to 26% for Sanders and Clinton's looming 59%. But that's okay, says O'Malley.
Well, you know what? I kind of like a tough fight. I've always been drawn to tough fights. I think the tough fights bring out the best in us. I think the tough fights might be the way the hidden God has of telling us we're actually fighting for something worth saving.
And while that may sound like something straight off the stump, and it is, he's used it on other crowds before, the evening was less a rally and more a conversation. After talking for about half an hour, O'Malley shed his suit jacket, rolled up his shirt sleeves, and took questions from 8 students in the audience. Diane DaCosta, a second-year undergraduate at UVA from Howard County, Maryland, touched on a hot topic. With the United Nations Climate Change Conference currently underway in Paris, she asked...
My question is regarding climate change, and you recognize that the younger generation believes in climate change, know it's a real thing, but how do we communicate that? How do we communicate that to the older generations and those who disbelieve the data?
You guys have to do that. Look, I'm counting on you, in fact, to do that. I said kind of, I think, in passing that I rarely meet young Americans under 30 that deny that climate change is real. As Democrats, we believe in science.
O'Malley drew applause 8 times from the crowd over the course of the hour. And if length and volume were any gauge, the issues most dear to the students were immigration reform and women's rights.
Yes, I believe that there are some decisions that are best left to women and their doctors. There are some decisions that governments know good at making.
But for all of their support around specific issues, the crowd of young voters appeared to be more undecided than firmly in O'Malley's camp. Nobody carried a sign or donned a shirt with his name on it. There were no impromptu chants taken up either for him or any other candidate. One student in the audience had a phone case with Bernie Sanders' face plastered on it, if that counts. I caught up with 22-year-old Terry Mason afterwards. He's a second-year Master's of Public Policy student at the Batten School. And as president of the Batten Graduate Council, he introduced O'Malley to the crowd earlier that evening. Mason said he was impressed, but that he, like many of his peers, is still searching for whom he'll support.
How do they feel? I know that there are definitely a lot of people in the Batten School that support Governor O'Malley, but we have a very broad spectrum. We have lots of conservatives, lots of Democrats, lots of independents and people in the middle. And it's for a lot of individuals, especially on the Republican side, it's wide open field right now.
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
Heroin use is up in the state of Virginia. In fact, more Virginians died of overdosing from heroin and prescription drugs than from car crashes in 2014. The Attorney General's office is hoping that a new film can help. Virginia Public Radio's Mallory No Pain reports.
Heroin is more dangerous, more addictive, more potent, and more deadly than any drug epidemic Virginia has ever seen.
The documentary is part of a public awareness campaign being spearheaded by Virginia's Attorney General Mark Herring. He's made combating drug abuse a priority. Virginians who have lost a loved one or survived overdoses share their stories in the film.
My mom found me in my room, so I was pretty much dead.
The state is just over 1 year into an initiative to drive down use of heroin. Because most overdoses occur in young adults ages 25 to 34, education is a large part of that initiative. The film is premiering at the Library of Virginia in Richmond this week. Screenings are also being held in Roanoke, Arlington, Culpeper, and Hampton Roads. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
Virginia politicians are already gearing up for 2017 elections. Delegate Rob Bell announced on Thursday that he's running for the Commonwealth's Attorney General. And Mallory Nopain has that report.
Delegate Bell, a Republican from Albemarle County, ran for his party's nomination in 2013, but lost to Republican Senator Mark Obenshain. Obenshain then went on to lose the general election to Democrat Mark Herring. Herring will be in the office until 2017. The Attorney General is an important player in state politics, interpreting and enforcing the state's laws. Bell says if elected, he wouldn't let his political opinions get in the way of that job.
My job is to take the law, and if I don't like it, that's not really a basis for not representing the Commonwealth.
The Attorney General also represents the state, picking which battles to fight with the federal government. Bell says he believes in a limited federal government.
I would not hesitate for 1 second. I believe that's part of the job, representing Virginia against federal overreach or against a law that's not proper.
Current Attorney General Mark Herring has already announced that he'll also be in the running for the office. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
You probably know comedian and writer Paula Poundstone best from laughing along with her every weekend, or just about every weekend, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me here on WMRA. But she's making a pretty serious argument these days against the mobile devices, the smartphones, the tablets, and the laptops that most of us cannot seem to do without. And she argues that these devices are actually damaging our children's brains. That's where my conversation with her started. So I'm watching CBS Sunday Morning this past Sunday, and lo and behold, there's Paula Poundstone with a commentary about kids' addiction to smartphones and devices. And, you know, you're talking about getting our kids off of the technology and doing other things, and it'll help them learn if we do that. And I'm seeing lots of people watching that, and we're nodding our heads and we're saying, yeah, Paula, give them hell. And then we go right back to playing, you know, Candy Crush or Googling something.
Yeah, because we're all addicts. And we are, should we decide to take action, we will be squaring off against, you know, huge corporate interest. And by the way, it's mild what devices are available now as compared to what's on its way to us. Virtual reality machines are coming in, and I find it impossible to believe that some machine that can convince you that you're someplace else doing something else isn't inherently brain damaging. In my experience, now I haven't talked to every teacher that there is, and I haven't done a scientific poll, but in my experience, I have lots and lots of teachers who communicate with me. Ironically, you know, I got a huge response on Twitter, and right. You know, a strong percentage of which was teachers,
sure,
saying, "Yeah, you're right," and I know I'm right. My son suffers severe electronics addictions, which is what, in addition to the pull that I feel myself, I mean, there are days where, you know, I check email and Twitter so many times. If I checked my regular mailbox that often, my neighbors would do an intervention. Right. You know, my son for a little while was in a private school, so I put him in the school thinking, well, just if there were more pairs of eyes on him, you know, if he, you know, that was really the number one reason. I just felt like our public school way too big for him. So I put him in this private school that became more and more computer centric during the time that he was there. to the degree that I would write a teacher an email during the day, and they would get back to me disturbingly quickly. For me, I generally work at night, and therefore the daytime, while my son is in school, is a very easy time for me to write an email. It should not be an easy time for a teacher to write an email.
Right.
And, well, you know, it's a funny complaint, like, yeah, you get back to me too fast. You know, I would just prefer that during that time they'd be teaching. It seems like we have this thing, and now that we have this thing, and everyone's addicted to this thing, we keep trying to find a virtuous reason to have it. So both publicly and privately, I talk to lots of people about this. And a lot of times for the parent, what happens is right away, they feel guilty, a bit scared because we're going towards their personal stash. And it has nothing to do with their kid at all for a few seconds, just for themselves. They feel like, I couldn't use my thing. And so quickly they say to me, it's good for hand-eye coordination. And I, you know, again, I'm aware that we have a deficit in the area of math and science in our country. I have yet to hear that there is a hand-eye coordination problem in our country. And that's addiction talking entirely. And I know a lot about addiction because of my own, you know, experience with alcohol and because of watching my poor son. And if it were drugs and alcohol, by the way, I would hold him somewhat responsible because he was raised knowing that that was not a good idea.
Yeah.
But in this case, I put him in front of a computer when he was a kid.
We're the pushers.
Yes, exactly.
And we're using right along with them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like telling your kid don't do heroin, you know, while you shoot up a few feet away. And it's not any better for us than it is for kids. The only difference is their brains are developing. And so I'm telling you, years from now, we're going to look back at this, and we're going to, an entire generation is going to see it as a form of child abuse.
I want to ask you about women in comedy, if it's okay.
Sure. Many of them are addicted.
Well, I'm wondering what your view is of the environment for women comics these days.
You know, I really don't know. And the reason I don't know is, you know, you'd have to travel back in time and isolate variables to figure out if being a woman has any bearing at all in stand-up comedy. I think, you know, people talk a lot about, they say, oh, you know, there's so many more women now than there used to be. I think percentage-wise, it's the same as it always has been. I mean, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a stand-up comic anymore. Among the largely male population of stand-up comics, I think the sliver of the pie that is women is about the same as, you know, same percentage as it always was.
I have to say that some of the funniest moments that I remember from you on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me are when you're interacting with some crazy scientific study that Peter Sagal is mentioning, and something just sets you off. And you obviously have a good grasp of science. Is that where you get it? Like you're?
Oh,
like,
no, I don't have a good grasp of science.
It sounds
all.
Like you do.
No, I'm an idiot. Honestly, I am the village idiot of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Not by design. It's just worked out that way.
No, I don't believe that.
Others are all so smart. No, you don't have to be. You don't have to be knowledgeable about science to see that there is something inherently unscientific about a study that shows that cats are the only animals that don't forgive. That was one that he had one time. I said, okay, but how do you know if a hippo has forgiven you? That's ridiculous. There's one cat that I can never catch. And like when I go to do everybody's nails, I just can't get this one cat. And I'm like, I'll just wait until she's stuck to the carpet. And then I can easily sneak up on her.
Paula Poundstone has won a long list of awards as a comedian and as a writer. And you can hear her often on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Paula, it was a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. It was nice talking with you.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe.
Lurking at the center of our Milky Way galaxy is an object we cannot see. It weighs about 4 million times the mass of our sun and occupies a volume of space about the size of our solar system. Oh, and it devours everything in its immediate vicinity. Do you know what this monster in the dark is? It's a supermassive black hole, of course. Black holes have long been a mathematical curiosity predicted by Einstein's equations of general relativity. Astronomers using the Keck telescopes atop Mauna Kea, Hawaii, have been staring at the center of our galaxy every few months or so for the last 20 years. What they found are a number of stars orbiting an object that we don't see in the optical. But just as we can figure out the mass of our sun from knowing the average sun-Earth distance and the fact it takes a year to make one complete orbit, we can use the same Keplerian physics to measure that the center of our galaxy is home to a black hole that weighs 4 million times the mass of our sun. This is the object those stars are orbiting. The existence of the supermassive black hole at our galactic center is betrayed by its gravitational effect on its nearby stars. How did it get there? How did it grow so big? What role does it play in how our galaxy changes with time? Great questions, but we really don't know. But the next time your child is afraid of monsters lurking in the dark, tell them about the one at the center of our galaxy. For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Varani.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bip and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. But we could use your help, too. Find out how you can contribute to the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.